Hello, and welcome to Critics Talk. I'm Jacob Davis, and with me today is an actor with a long accomplished career, Ernest Perry Jr., who is currently in the Goodman's production of Two Trains Running by August Wilson, which is a part of a big festival related to August Wilson that's being put on throughout the city. Hello, Ernest.
How you doing, Jacob?
So, I've already written a review of this play for ChicagoCritic.com, and I thought it was wonderful. Ernest plays the role of Hambone, but I thought maybe you would like to start off by telling our listeners a little bit about what happens in this play and who your character is.
Well, Hambone is one of those characters that comes out of most communities. He's usually referred to as an illiform type of person, a person who's labeled as mentally retarded or whatnot. In the African American community, we figure people like that are especially touched by the deity, God, Allah, whatever your thing is, because they have an intelligence and innate sense that people tend to overlook. Even in previous productions of this play, they kind of dismissed the character of Hambone or used him as comic relief when he is anything but comic relief. He knows what's going on. He represents the African American struggle in this country. He's not going to work 300 years for nothing and not take a lunch. He's going to go after what he feels is right and just.
And I think that is apparent in the way you play the character, because even though you only have a few lines which you repeat, your expressions are always very clear. And I was wondering about that, because Hambone is probably a very different sort of challenge to play from other characters you're used to.
Hambone is one of the most challenging roles I've ever had in my career. I met with the director, Chuck Smith. He says, okay, we're not going to throw this guy away, but give me something. You know, and Chuck and I go way back, so we don't need an elaborate thing to go through. And I said, okay. So I started with the description that the funeral director, Wes, gives. He says, I've never seen anything like it. The man had scars all over his body, back, leg, the leg. Okay, that means somebody curb stomped him somewhere along in his life, so he probably has a little limp. And if you got scars all over your body, it's like being burned. You never really fully recover from something like that, and that causes you to, you know, have shakes and twitches and whatnot. You know, so you just kind of like layer that in. It doesn't affect his intelligence, but it does affect his physicality. But he is steadfast, and he's like a laser beam. He's honed in on that one thing. I want my ham, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And until he gets that, he ain't going nowhere else. He ain't doing nothing else. He ain't thinking about nothing else. But he's aware of everything around him. Like when the man say he going hire the guy to sit down there with his shotgun. Ham won't know about this guy. you know how many cats he done shot and whatnot. You know, so he's tuned in, but he's focused on his objective.
Mm-hmm. That's true, and I think what's interesting about this character is that August Wilson is known for writing these very long stories that he puts in these characters' mouths, but Hambone doesn't have that. So you made up your own for him based on what was in the text.
Yes, he's succinct. He's right on it. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't need the other stuff. But then, you know, where August hung out listening to these cats, there were dudes like Hambone. That's why he was able to encapsulate him in those few lines, you know. But that's, we come from an oral history, mm-hmm. So that's what he's going to do. And we were blessed by the fact that August was not inundated with a formal education, mm-hmm. in this country. You know, they accused him of plagiarism, I think, when he was a freshman in high school. He had already been kicked out of a Catholic high school because of he was a mixed marriage. I mean, he had to face being called a nigger every day that he went to school, and then he had to get into a fight, so they kicked him out. Mm-hmm. Went to a parochial school. If you know anything about the educational system, and it's like a demotion. You go from Catholic to parochial, it's like, hey. And then he was accused of plagiarizing a paper he wrote about one of his favorite historical characters, Napoleon. Wrote a 20-page paper about it, and the man accused him of plagiarism, so he just said, to hell with it, and went to the library and educated himself, which I have a great appreciation for, because there's that similarity between him and my father, who was also from the South and didn't have but that formal education. But I think too much is stressed about that, and so he didn't have to filter his way through that, because he did it himself, and so that's why it has that richness in it.
Mm-hmm. Because August Wilson's portrayals of people is based on his observations of them, and that must be part of what appeals to you so strongly about his writing.
Exactly. You know, was it somebody, I think it was that lady in the Sun-Times, asked me a question, and I said, well, you have to be bilingual to do August Wilson, mm-hmm. especially if you've been educated in this country, you know, because I come from a high school out there in Evanston. When I graduated, it was the number 3 or 2 high school in the country. And they trained you not to end your sentences in preposition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you go through this script, and that's all August do is end his sentence in preposition. Of, at, and then about. So you have to know how to speak like black people talk, whether it's the Hill District or Chicago or wherever, you know, and so that's what I mean by being bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to know to get away from that structure thing. Plus, he has a rhythm associated with blues and jazz. He's been influenced by the artwork of Romar Bearden and what have you. So you have to take all of these things into consideration when you interpret that character and trying to get to where he wants you to get to.
That's interesting. And what I got from the show, part of the reason why the Goodman selected Two Trains Running as opposed to one of August Wilson's maybe better known works like Fences or The Piano Lesson, was because they thought it was a work that was very personal. Because, as you say, August Wilson wrote a play for each decade of the 20th century, and he was basing his earlier ones off of what he heard from people. But Two Trains Running, which is the play that takes place in the 60s, would be the first play chronologically that Wilson wrote about an era that he lived through as an adult. And I was wondering what your perspective on that was, if you also had first-hand experience of the period that he's talking about, how that compares, and whether there's a difference between August Wilson's work that takes place after the 60s or that takes place before.
I did a play reading last night of Fences, which was the first play that I did by August. I was the understudy for James Earl Jones, Ray Arana, Frankie Faison, Charlie Brown. And that touched me, I think, more than anything else, because my father started out as one of those cats who walked behind the garbage truck and lifted cans. Him and he had a good friend named Joe Cater. And when he transitioned, he was one of the first black cats to become a driver, mm-hmm. Village of Wilmette. When he left there at the end of his 30, 40 years, he was acting superintendent for the Village of Wilmette. So Fences has a very special place in my heart. Now, the decade of the 60s, oh yeah, that's me. I was telling somebody the other day, I said, this is probably the most violent decade that August wrote about. Kennedy elected in 60, Medgar Evers shot in 63, well, assassinated. K- Kennedy assassinated 63. And a lot of people forget about George Lincoln Rockwell, who headed up the Nazi party in this country. They assassinated his ass. They took Malcolm out the game. They took King out the game. They took Robert Kennedy out the game. And let us not forget Mark Clark and Fred Hampton on the West Side, December the 4th, 1969. I remember that very vividly because I was getting on a plane to go to Vietnam to defend this country. So that's a very volatile decade, and it had a strong impact because civil rights, black power, they was taking off bras, burning them, they was against the war. I mean, everything was going down. So it's really a trip. This whole thing about regentrification and rehabbing, that was going on. They was destroying African-American communities all across this country in the name of rehabbing, you know. If you take that pill, the Hill District in Pittsburgh, it was just thriving, you know, financially. When they split that thing up, and it was like with the Yoruba and the Igbos in Nigeria, you know, boom, they split them up and they went to war in 67. Yeah, went to the school with a cat named Kashmir who couldn't go home at that time, you know. So it was just an incredible decade, really.
So you appreciate the way that Wilson depicts it in this play that focuses on not the big name people.
No, you don't have to. He nailed it, though. Because you're talking about how does this affect the everyday guy? You know, the cat that owns a funeral home or the cat that does the numbers, you know. I tell them, I say, yeah, I remember the cat that ran numbers in Evanston. They don't think they had a numbers run in Evanston, but they did. You know, and he was just brilliant because he had that little stogie, but he didn't use paper or pencil. It was all up here. So if he was ever busted, you know, they didn't have no evidence on him, you know. And I never ever saw him in a car. He walked wherever he went. Wherever you saw him, he just walked, you know. But there was a steeliness to him that you knew, because when you're carrying that kind of money, you got to pay people. You got to be able to back that up. You know, that's just, and Wolf just is incredible, and Anthony Irons does a wonderful job. We're blessed to have a wonderful cast because, I mean, ain't nobody on no ego trip. Everybody is familiar with August's work and what the sacrifices require, you know, to do this. And that's one of the things that is the bedrock of this production, you know. I mean, everybody. Linda Buchanan, Birgit, the costume designer, John Colbert, the lighting designer, Ray Nardelli, my God, the man just went and stole all that sound from Motown. It's just beautiful. Wherever you go, stage management, custodians, I mean, it just all comes together. You know, this lady, her crew, everybody has just come together to make this one of the best productions I've ever been in.
You do have a wonderful production team, and I'm glad that you brought them up, because as somebody who pretty much sees everything, I remembered seeing a lot of these same actors in a production of Waiting for Godot only about 6 weeks ago. And I certainly think that influenced the way I saw the play. And I was wondering how your perspective on the play changes, because it was written in 1993, as you acquire new experiences, and whether different characters you've played sometimes bleed through into your life or into other characters or help give you a different perspective on things. So I'm basically asking how you see August Wilson's plays differently now from back when you were understudying from James Earl Jones.
That's the one thing that I really can appreciate. I think James Earl's child was maybe 3 years old when he did Fences here in 86. I had a daughter that was born in 80, so that made her six, and another one four. And I really had no understanding of what Troy was about. But when I went to the Arden Theater 2005, I had reared two daughters. So I had a better understanding of what Troy was about. I mean, I had the basic understanding of Troy trying to protect his son from what he had gone through. I mean, it can't get any clearer when he says, what kind of sense do that make? The man Selkirk batting 269 and playing right field for the Yankees. I'm batting 437 with 32 home runs. Come on, what kind of sense? You can't make no sense out of that. And the only reason he's not playing right field for the Yankees is because of the color of his skin. And it makes no sense whatsoever. So they look at it like, well, you know, black men have trouble with their sons. No, that's not it. What did his father do to him? It's very evident, you know, that he was not loved and cared for, you know, by his father. So how would he know how to do with his son other than let me protect him from what I had to go through? So I understand that. And that's what's the key, I think, to playing Troy Maxson. If you have not raised a child, I'm not saying you can't play him, but it makes it much more difficult because you can hone right in on what the man is trying to do if you've raised a child. Now, in Two Trains, that's deep because, you know, one of the quotes that August has is, there are always two trains running. One is life, and one is death. And each of us rides both of them. And I can remember growing up with my grandfather in the house, and when somebody would die, and you come in, he'd say, so-and-so has paid the debt we all got to pay. And I said, wow, that's deep. Everybody got to pay that debt. And that's what's happening with these two trains. Yeah, you either living or you dying, you know. And it's a trip. It's a real live trip. But you just get next to it. As you grow older, you can appreciate and look back and no more. I'm shocked sometimes at the things that come out of my mouth because I forget how long I've lived, you know, and I've had all these plethora of experiences. I was very fortunate that my grandfather lived to be 111. And when you got a cat like that in the house, busting your brain with his knowledge, it's like, wow. You know, no formal education, couldn't write. And the vocabulary he had used to just blow me away. I'm saying, how does this cat know all this stuff? Well, when you live that long, you know, you acquire it and stuff, you know. He never believed that anybody had landed on the moon. He just, son, don't believe that. Ain't nobody been on that moon. And Bozo was his favorite character on TV. You know, I don't know why, but it was, you know. But he said, don't you ever believe that, that somebody been, ain't nobody been to the moon. And I believed him. Yeah.
Well, man, like that, memories must have gone back.
Oh, man. You know, and then I would tell my cousins, you know, because my mother went and got him and took him from the cousins who were in South Carolina. And I told them, I said, this cat kept me out of jail, kept me out of a lot of stuff, because he would just, and all my friends, we would come by and they'd sit and we'd listen to him. Just listen to him rap. Boom. You know, because, I mean, that's firsthand. You ain't got to crack a book. And he can tell you right, boom, how when he used to tap the trees for syrup and stuff and fill the can up and there'd be a little left over and he'd put it over here for the colored folks and stuff like that. How he worked on the railroad and all the different stuff that he did. And it was just incredible, man. Incredible. So I've been blessed in that respect. Yeah.
I have a sense now of where Wilson must have been getting some of his source material.
Yeah. The Mo-Cats, they lay it out for you, man. You know, and they be glad to do it, too, because they know. They know what's out there. Like this cat that they crucifying up there in Minnesota. It's so hard to get your head around it. The football player that whipped his son with a switch. I mean, I don't think there is a black man born from 1960 on back that didn't have to go out and pick his own switch to get his ass whooped. Because that's what black people did. I'm sorry, I didn't mean, you know. But, I mean, come on, I have gone, and you got to go and get a good, sturdy switch, because if they got to go and get it, you in trouble. And so it just makes no sense. You know, wait a minute. How you going to crucify this man for disciplining his son? Because they're always criticizing us for leaving our family, making it nuclear instead of extended. Black men, they just walk off, they don't do nothing with their sons. And then when you do something, they penalize you like that. It don't make no sense. How you gonna make sense out of that? Here you are, and that's one of the reasons that we do that. So that your son don't end up in the street like the boy down there in Ferguson with a bullet in his head. That's why you take a switch and beat him, so that the police don't kill him later in life. You know, there's a causal relationship between the way we raise our kids and how we have to go out here in this society. And I just don't understand it. My niece messed around there and fornicated in my sister's bed when she was 12 or 13 years old. And my sister whipped her, and so did her father. And she went to school the next day, teachers saw the welt on her, and they arrested my sister for child abuse. Now you tell me, what is she supposed to do? She was just lucky she was born in a different generation. If I had went and fornicated in my mother's bed, I would not be sitting here talking to you today. They would have killed me. Damn whipping, they would have killed me, man. I mean, Jesus Christ. Is this supposed to air? I'm messing it up, ain't it? You get deleted. Okay, cool.
It's up to you. So, generally when you're looking for a part, what is it that ideally will be there for you to work with? What is it about, not even August Wilson mm-hmm. necessarily, but just any playwright, when you're looking yeah. through a play, say, oh, that's a part that really gets me excited.
It's something that resonates. My job is to be the sponge, to soak up whatever it is the director wants or the playwright is trying to get across. I've spent my entire career being what is called a character actor. Mm-hmm. I once played the lead in a production here called Cry, the Beloved Country, that Stephen Camallo was directed by Frank Galati. But basically, you just absorb all of your own personal experiences, what the playwright has put there for you, and what the objective of the director is. And once you put all of, you know, it's like cooking. You have to become an alchemist and put all these ingredients together to come to it, you know. It's like when the director and I talked about ham bone, you know. It's like, okay, I got to get some ingredients from here, from there, boom, boom. And then we just start. And I didn't even realize I was doing it until I got this note from one of the ADs on opening night, who said, it has been a pleasure to watch you create this character, mm-hmm. to layer him day after day, week after week. I didn't even realize I was doing it. I was just saying, okay, this is what I got to get to. And you go about trying to do it every day, you know. And whatever the role is, I figure I can do it. If it's Hambone or if it's Stephen Camallo and everything in between, you know, because I like to be a part of the collective. Yeah, it's more rewarding for me, you know, than to be on some star trip. I ain't never went for that, you know. Yeah.
And there are several other playwrights you've had a lot of involvement in, and a rather eclectic selection of them.
Yeah.
And everything from Wilson to Shakespeare. Maybe that's not so different, really, but also.
Yeah. The one that stands out for me is Alice Childress, who penned, actually, she penned the first African-American play that was supposed to be on Broadway, mm-hmm. a thing called Trouble in Mind. It's just a very powerful piece. But, you know, like always, they wanted her to change the ending so it would be palatable to to the people that produce it, and she refused. So then A Raisin in the Sun became the first black play that they did on Broadway. But Trouble in Mind was the one that was, and it's not done enough, it really isn't, because it's just, whoo, it hits you with a wallop, and it's just a beautiful piece. It's just like this piece we're doing here now. You would say, okay, done in 93, written in 69, about the decade of the 60s, but just about every line that you hear in this play resonates in 2015, because the same things are going on, you know. And even though, God bless his soul, President Barack Obama has said things have changed, and they have. There's a line in there that Memphis says, yeah, we had to teach these niggas up here that they didn't have to jump off the sidewalk when white folks walked down. There's not many people who have had that experience of having to step off of a sidewalk into a curb to let white people walk down. I have had that experience walking uptown in Waynesboro, Georgia with my grandmother, and we had to get off the sidewalk and step into the street to let a little kid go by. That shit never leaves you, man. And that is so degrading, my God. You know, I didn't mind getting in the street, but I really resented having my grandmother, you know, had to step aside for that. Jesus Christ. I still get mad about it when I think about it. But you know, not many people don't know about that. You know, so they haven't had that kind of experience. And thank God they haven't. So we don't have to do that. We can drink out the same water fountain. We can eat in the same restaurant. We can go into the same hotel and catch the same bed bugs as everybody else. You know, I don't know. I guess they call that progress and so forth. But I don't know. I have a different take on it. I don't know. I kind of like the segregation. I mean, and we was brought up that way. So, you know, I think we've missed the boat on a lot of things. I was brought up out there in Evanston. And when I was brought up, there were 77 black-owned businesses. There was only one or two people in the whole state of Illinois that owned their own currency exchange. John Bryan out there on Simpson was one of them. So this was an example. Elizabeth Hill, who was the doctor for most of us that came through during my generation, graduated from Northwestern, did her residency in Providence, and then was denied working at Evanston Hospital. So what does she do? She builds her own hospital. So there's countless examples of that for young black men, young black women to see. We don't have that no more. We've moved from the extended family where uncles and brothers and sisters took care of each other to that nuclear family where you got one black woman and one child, or one black woman and three kids, you know. I can't see how that's progress. You know, that's going backwards as far as I'm concerned. But now progress has been made. Even though there's a man sitting there in the White House which they have no respect for, you know, and that just bugs the hell out of me. You know, we built that damn White House. Even when the blueprint got burned up, some cat with a photographic memory redid the blueprint, and then we did the, you know, but progress has still been made, you know. They just don't take us and hang us from trees like they used to. They just get on a bus and sing about it now, you know. So I guess that's progress. You know, it all depends on how you look at it.
Well, I guess my only other question then is, what do you think Hambone would ever do if he got his ham?
Go and paint somebody else's fence. Move on. You know, it's kind of hard to say, but he would just, because that's what he does. He's that handy guy in the neighborhood that does all the jobs that nobody else really wants to do. You know, they figure it's beneath them to do, like lions say. No, Pop, I can't punch no clock. I can't be picking up nobody's rubbish. Because he's he's coming from a different generation. Whereas Troy, he was grateful to be able to get that job. But that's the thought process from one generation to the next. You know, I was telling an actor the other day, I said, man, you got to be careful with August because he is in touch with the ancestors. And they work through you. I said, I was doing a play in Indiana, Jim and the Ocean playing Solly mm-hmm. Two Kings. And the director came to me and he says, Ernest, he says, I feel like you're holding back. I said, what you talking about? No, he says, something is trying to come through you, but it's not getting there. He said, just open yourself up to it. And I didn't realize it at the time, but it was the ancestors working through August, working through me. And when I got to that monologue about Solly Two Kings and the 63 slaves that he took from slavery to freedom, it just fucked me up and I started crying during the monologue. I still can't talk about it, man. Because they get in your body and boom, it just comes out and you have no control over it. None. So that's why I like this cat, because, I mean, you know, this gets deeper than deep, man, to be dealing with this stuff.
Well, it's a fine tribute to August Wilson that you're performing in now. And I think that gives an excellent example of how people can use it as a window into an era that is past now, but people are still here mm-hmm. and can hear their stories, and also hear around town the other August Wilson plays being done, a window into times that are either further back or further on ahead.
Right. Yeah. It's two trip, yeah.
Well, I think Two Trains Running goes on through April 12th.
Yeah.
And please. Ernest Perry will be there the whole time as Hambo.
I think so. And thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it, man. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure talking to you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right.